We're reading from the 10th canto, chapter 7, text 16 and 17. 17 is on the board. I will read 16. And then we will chant 17, and then I will read the translation for 16 and 17. And they both have purports. So, text 17. All right, I'll read the translation. I don't want to keep you in suspense. Translation, Nanda Maharaj, for the sake of the affluence of his own son Krishna, gave the brahmanas cows, fully decorated with garments, flower garlands, and gold necklaces. These cows, fully qualified to give ample milk, were given to the brahmanas in charity. And the brahmanas accepted them and bestowed blessings upon the whole family and especially upon Krishna. Nanda Maharaj first fed the brahmanas sumptuously and then gave them in charity first-class cows decorated with golden necklaces, garments, and flower garlands. Could you imagine? There'd be no way you could keep a golden necklace on a cow today because it would be stolen, right? But in those days, gold was not in shortage. Now most men can't afford a gold necklace for their wives. And here they're given to their cows. So today's verse, translation. The brahmanas, who were completely expert in chanting the Vedic hymns, were all yogis fully equipped with mystic powers. Whatever blessings they spoke were certainly never fruitless. Purport. Well, the last verse in it said that Nanda Maharaj, for the opulence, what's the word here? For the affluence of Krishna, he gave the brahmanas cows in charity. And then it said the brahmins bestowed blessings. So he wanted Krishna's affluence, and the Brahmins blessed, so that was certification. When the Brahmins blessed, that everything would be good, right? And you never want to displease a Brahmin, you never want a Brahmin to curse you, you want a Brahmin to bless you, right? So, this verse is saying, is kind of extending that idea, it said the Brahmins were expert in chanting Vedic hymns. What does that mean? That they were Sanskrit scholars? No, it means they had Shakti. They were bona fide. They were pure. So when they chanted the Vedic hymns, they had Shakti, right? Like we hear, you could chant a hymn and give an animal a new life. You could chant the chatras could chant mantras and shoot weapons. So their qualification was not Sanskrit. Their qualification was their purity. They were actually sattvic. And purity is the force, Prabhupada said, so they had power. So they were so pure, when they chanted the mantra, as they had said here, the mantras were effective. So that extends the idea, because they chant the mantras, they're effective. That means whenever they gave a blessing, it would be effective because they're pure. So what they said happens. That's the idea. And so this is glorifying the Brahmins here, this verse, just saying, yes, they actually did give their blessings, and the blessings, whatever blessings Brahmins give, real Brahmins, they become fact. Right? Then it's very good that in Kali Yuga, the Brahmins don't have these blessings, because if whatever they said became a fact, that would be dangerous, so-called Brahmins, right? Or Brahmins on their way up. If everything you said would happen, just imagine what your life would be like. Or the life of the people around you. I don't want to see so-and-so Prabhu. I hope he doesn't come to the temple today. So by that desire, somehow or other, he won't come. Wouldn't that be unusual? Like there would be chaos everywhere because everyone's desires, if they're not pure, would be creating chaos, right? So Brahman is given this power because he's pure, so he will only desire something good. And a Vaishnava Brahman, if he curses, it's only for good. Sometimes you see in Shastra how Durvasa Muni will curse or these sages will curse. And the idea is they're not devotees, so sometimes they curse out of anger. They become overcome by passion and they curse someone. But a Vaishnava would never curse anyone unless the curse would have a benefit, right? I curse you. You'll have no material happiness. Well, that's a blessing, actually. Because then you'll only have Krishna. So that kind of curse a Vaishnava might give. Prabhupada said that he got that curse. He was supposed to be wealthy, but he got the blessing of his spiritual master. It wouldn't happen, and so he had to preach. So, yes. So, and Prabhupada, he desired so many things for the welfare of others, and then it happened by his desire. So the purport, Brahmanas fully equipped with the brahminical qualifications are always yogis, fully powerful in mystic yoga. Their words never fail. In every transaction with other members of society, Brahmins are certainly dependable. In this age, however, one must take into account that the Brahmins are uncertain in their qualifications. That means, I think that's another way of saying they're not qualified, or we're not certain they're qualified, or it's dubious they're qualified, or they're not qualified, or many are not qualified. Because there are no yajnik Brahmins, all yajnas are forbidden. The only yajna recommended in this, in other words, you don't want to take a cow and put it in a fire and chant your mantras to give it a new body in Kali Yuga because the cow's going to die in the fire. And he's not going to come out with a new body on the other side because there's no yajnik Brahmins to do it. In fact, when this happened after, you know, Kali Yuga began, they were still thinking they could do these yajnas, and they did one and the cow burnt. And one of these Brahmins, his mind went wild because he smelt, you know, the charred aroma of the flesh and he wanted to eat it. Do you know that? Yeah. He buried it to come get it later. And where it was buried was growing onions and garlic, and a voice said, just mix your vegetables with onions and garlic, it'll taste like meat. Don't eat the meat. And as we know, the degradation of Kali Yuga began with the degradation of Brahmins. I was on the way over here, I was thinking of the story of Vena, right? King Vena. And King Vena was, I mean, he was bad. I mean, very bad. And so the Brahmins, at some point they said, we have to impeach him. And the way the Brahmins impeached him was through mantra. They didn't have a political process, and the mantra just kills him, you know, just like, whoosh. Okay. So it shows the power of the Brahmins. They can just, okay, this ruler needs to be eliminated. Now, to eliminate a ruler, it's quite kind of difficult. You have to track him down, and it could take years, right? Hiding in some cave in the mountains in Afghanistan. But the Brahmins were so powerful, they could... Whoosh. So I was thinking, if there were real Brahmins today, Donald Trump would probably have been killed by mantra. What do you think? They would say, no. Of course, you could extend that and say they probably would kill every candidate. But particularly that one, I think he's competing with Maharaj Vena. So if there were real Brahmins in the world, they wouldn't allow this to happen. Isn't it? What do you think? They could just chant a mantra. But the point is, they had the discretion. So if they had the power to curse or kill or bless, they had the discretion who to kill, who to bless, who to curse. That's a Brahmin, because Brahmin is selfless and they're only interested in the welfare of others. So when you're on that level, Krishna will give you that power because you can use it. And if you're not on that level and you have that power, it'll be destructive. And you see that, right? Any person who's given too much power, who is not pure, they misuse it, and it's destructive. The only yajna recommended in the age of Kali is Sankirtan yajna. Yajnai Sankirtana Payar Yajanti Husumeda Saha. Bhagavatam 11.5.32. Yajna is meant to satisfy Vishnu. Yajnahartat karmano nyatra lokoyam karma bandhanaha. Because in this age there are no qualified brahmanas, people should perform yajna by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. Yajnai Sankirtana Payar Yajanti Hu Hi Sumeda Saha. Life is meant for yajna, and yajna is performed by the chanting of Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. So I thought we could begin this class. Well, it already began. We can continue this class by talking about brahmanas. Are we brahmanas or are we Vaishnavas? What are we actually? Do you know that before the time of Bhaktisiddhanta, many people, when they became Vaishnavas, who as children were initiated as Brahmins in Brahmin families, young boys about the age of 12 were given initiation. It was called Upanayanam. And they were given a sacred thread, and they were given Gayatri Mantra. And that was the beginning of their education. So when they got the thread and the initiation, they were now qualified to study Shastra and do Vedic deity worship, Vedic puja. Not the kind of puja we do. We do Pancharatriki, but they had certain restrictions, but that was the system, right? If you're from a Brahmin family. So many of these Brahmins would become Vaishnavas. And Mahaprabhu said, Naham Vipro, I'm not a Brahmin. So he was demonstrating the transcendental nature that Vaishnavas are beyond Brahmins, right? We're not part of Varnashram. So in those days, before the time of Bhaktisiddhanta, when you got initiation, you would take your thread off. Isn't that interesting? Now you get initiation, you get a thread. In those days, you took it off to demonstrate you were no longer part of Varnashram. You were transcendental. Now you're a devotee is above a Brahmin. Isn't that funny? Okay. Now we put the threads on. In those days, they took them off. At the time of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he changed as a preaching technique, because Brahmins puffed up with their puffed up because of their position being born in Brahmin families, thought if you're not born in a Brahmin family, pretty much you're useless and you're inferior. What to speak of becoming a Brahmin? They didn't even really accept him as really as Vaishnavas. Anyway, so Vaishnavas did not put on the sacred thread or chant Brahma Gayatri Mantra. That was Brahminical culture within Varnashram. But Bhaktisiddhanta wanted to demonstrate that Vaishnavas are also Brahmins, really better than Brahmins. But people thought Vaishnavas were lower. And so he said, when you get initiated, what we call second initiation, you get diksha, you'll be given the Brahmin thread and the Gayatri Mantra to show the world that you are Brahmins. It was actually a preaching technique, not a process of purification. Isn't that interesting? Like, we all have our threads, but, you know, in England, it might be a preaching technique, but we don't go around showing people our threads, and the Westerners don't know what threads are anyway. And they don't know what a Brahmin is and a Vaishnava is. But so now its effect is a little different. But in those days, it was particularly for that purpose. Isn't that interesting? But another interesting factor is that we know Vaishnavas are transcendental, and any of us can be initiated as Brahmins. But in Gaudiya Math, whenever it was time to do yajnas and like that, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta would have the devotees who were raised as Brahmins do it, because they learned that as kids growing up as Brahmins. So he let them, they were the expert in Brahminical activity. Anyway, when Prabhupada came to America, as you know, and as he traveled the world, as you know, he used to say, society is brainless, and I think that's been proven by the elections in America. Not only did they put on the fact that they nominated someone who's brainless, that also means the people who nominated them are also lacking in that upstairs quarter. As Bhagavatam says, if you vote in a person who's like a dog, that means you must also be a dog. Or a persons who are like dogs, hogs, camels, and asses. Vote for persons who are like dogs, hogs, camels, and asses. Right? So Prabhupada used to say, no brain. And I think this demonstrates it probably better than anything that's happened, at least in American history, maybe the history of the world. I don't know. I'm not a historian. There may be other brainless acts. But this rates up there, doesn't it? It's high on the charts of brainless acts. So when we were being charged as brainwashing, it was in the mid-70s in America, there was a case against us that we were brainwashing. And Prabhupada said, we're not brainwashing. You don't even have a brain that we could wash, so how can you charge us of brainwashing? Actually, we're giving you a brain. So that's the purpose of Brahmins, right? The purpose of Brahmins is to give brain. Of course, sometimes Prabhupada said, yes, we're washing your brain. It needs washing. It's not bad. It's actually good. If it's dirty and we wash it, you should appreciate it, right? So people say we're brainwashing. In one sense, we could agree. Yeah. But in another sense, first show me the brain that I could wash, right? So Prabhupada's mood was, we will create Brahmins. But Vaishnavas are already Brahmins, already better than Brahmins. So when Prabhupada said we're creating Brahmins, what did he mean? He said we're creating a class of men who are the head, who have knowledge. And so we give knowledge. Without knowledge, society is doomed. Yes? So, in the lecture, Prabhupada said, well, this was Prabhupada's strategy. As you probably know, if you joined ISKCON in 1966 or 67, a few weeks later you would get initiated. Did you know that? Yeah. I joined January of 1970. I moved in the temple. About January 20th. I was initiated about March 20th, something like that. So in those days, it went from 2 weeks to 2 months. And I didn't ask to be initiated. That was also a little detail. You weren't asking, you were just on the conveyor belt. By time you were in the movement, then you would be initiated. Oh, you've been here 2 weeks, you'll be initiated. You've been here 2 months, you'll be initiated. A little different today, isn't it? I think the UK has the highest standards for being initiated, very strict standards. But we want to make sure who's ever being initiated is actually qualified, so we have strict standards. But in those days, not so strict. Even for many, many years after I was initiated, not so strict. Then it went up to like 6 months. And 1 year, I think, 6 months later, you could get second initiation. So let's look at a little history. Initiation, traditionally in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, was not first initiation, second initiation. It was one initiation, which combined our first and second. That's what it was. So you were given Harinam, You take your vows and you are given your Gayatri mantras, Pancharatriki mantras. That was initiation. And those initiations were given by people who were sattvic, who could follow the principles. But when Srila Bhaktisiddhanta expanded his preaching, he was preaching to people who were not sattvic, who were not Vaishnavas or not Brahmins. And so it was a little dangerous to give that whole initiation at one time. Because the idea is if you get brahminical initiation, that means you're in sattva-gun. And sattva-gun means no meat eating, no illicit sex, no gambling, no intoxication. And you're steady in doing that. That's sattva-gun. Right? Because meat eating, illicit sex, intoxication, gambling are part of rajas and tamas. Right? So if you're in rajas and tamas, that's what you're dealing with. You know? If you say, I'm in maya, what do you mean? The mode of passion or ignorance is strongly influencing me. If I'm feeling lust, anger, greed, envy, it's passion, ignorance, right? So, brahmana is situated in goodness. Samo damas taposo cham chantir arjavamevacham. Gyanam vijnanam ashtikam brahma karma subhavajam. A Brahmin is peaceful. Why is he peaceful? He explains it in Bhagavatam. How do you become peaceful? Tata rajas tamo bhava. When the lower modes leave you, you become peaceful. Oh, no more passion. Oh, no more ignorance. I feel so much better. I feel peaceful. Right? Passion and ignorance are like ropes around our neck. Come, we're going this way. And you have no say in it. Feels like you have no say in it, right? Just getting pulled. So, tado rajas tamo bhava kamo laba dayas chaye. Tado rajas tamo bhava. When rajas and tamas subside, kama goes away, loba, greed goes away, chaye, etc. Sri Sri Radha Gokula Ananda Kija. Kama, loba, chayas daye. Kama, loba, etc. You're familiar with the etc.? Kama is lust, loba is greed, etc. It's like a whole package. Lust, anger, greed, envy, jealousy, resentment, anger is a whole package. Because it's all those lower modes. So when you're dealing in lower modes, you don't just get lust without the greed and the envy and the jealousy. They all come together. Isn't it? And when you go to goodness, you get a whole new package. You know, samo, damas, tapos, sama, peacefulness, dhamma, sense control, tapa, austerity, socham, cleanliness. When you get to goodness, you actually like doing austerity. Let's go to Vrindavan Kartik. Let's like eat once a day and chant 64 rounds and don't wear shoes. Get up at 2 a.m. and you tell that to your friend, you know, who's not a devotee, and they think, my God, are you crazy? You want to torture yourself? And you say, no, this is nectar. I love it. I love getting up and taking a cold shower at 2 a.m. It's ecstatic. Right? Yeah. And your friend, he's in the mode of ignorance, and he says, no, 2 a.m. at the bar, at the pub, that's ecstatic. Right? So it's a package. So when you get to sattva, you get the package. Samo, damas, tapa. You like austerity, socham. You like it clean. If things aren't clean, you go crazy. Actually, the definition of Brahman is he leaves the place cleaner. Right? Now, if we followed that definition, nobody would have to clean the temple because everywhere you'd go, you'd be cleaning. Right? We wouldn't even need a temple commander to organize temple cleaning because it would just get clean because Brahmins are always cleaning. Samadhamastaposo cham, shantir, tolerance, shantir arjavam, honesty, Brahmins are truthful. And ashtikam, religious. They follow religious practice. They're dharmic. So, when you become sattvic, all these other things, these lower modes, leave you and you feel sama. Ah, feels so good. I feel peaceful. Peaceful, the definition of peace for us, bhukti mukti siddhi kami, shakaliya shanta. If you want to be liberated, if you want sense gratification, anything you want, you're not peaceful. So when you come to sattva, the sign is you become peaceful. And unless there's a class of people who are peaceful, they can't be interested in the welfare of others, because when you're not peaceful, you always want something. Yes? That's the definition, Chaitanya Charitamrita. Everybody wants something other than the devotee. And if you want something, how can you help somebody else? Because you'll preach to them and then you'll think, what can I get from them? Maybe they'll... I went to their house to preach and I saw that they had this really nice... She had a really nice set of earrings. Maybe I can get them from her. I saw he had this amazing guitar. I always wanted this guitar. Maybe I can ask him for it. I'll preach to him, tell him it's for Krishna. And that guitar goes in your room and nobody touches it. Right? So you understand the idea? That how can you help somebody unless you're pure? So there has to be a class of people that are sama. They're not bhukti, mukti, siddhi, kami. They don't want anything in this world. Those are the only people that can help the world. You agree? And so our movement is a movement of compassion. We're always preaching about compassion. And how do you become compassionate? You become compassionate by becoming pure, because when you're pure, you stop thinking about yourself. And now you have time to think about other people, because you're not preoccupied thinking about what you want. Yes? How did Prabhupada spread Krishna consciousness? He wasn't thinking about himself. Right? That's how you do it. Oh, Prabhu, I just want to save the world. Yeah. How do you save the world? Become a pure devotee first. That's how you do it, right? First become a pure devotee before you're going to go out and save the world. You know, it's like the Prabhupada said, the third class servant. You tell him what to do and he runs out to do it and then he forgets. It's like, yeah, I'm going to go save the world, you know. And you go out to save the world and you go, I'm a little tired now. Maybe I'll take a little rest. You know. Actually, I'm hungry. I think I'll eat something. You understand the principle. You have to be pure. Right? So, Prabhupada's idea, create a class of people who are pure, and those class of people will change the world. And how will they become pure? Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama. Now, something interesting happened in ISKCON. When I was a young devotee, do you realize the word Vedic was like, if some devotee said Vedic, you'd go, poo-poo. You know, you have that word in England, poo-poo? You poo-poo something? No? You have it? Yes? Vedic. He's talking about, we're not Vedic. There was no debate, Vedic, non-Vedic. If the word came up, poo-poo. We're Vaishnavas, we're transcendental. We're not trying to be Vedic. That was our philosophy. We're spreading Lord Chaitanya Sankirtan movement, it's transcendental. We're not Vedic. We do whatever we have to do. We wear whatever kind of dress we have to wear to distribute Prabhupada's books. We do what we need to do. That was the philosophy. That was it. No one even, there was no ever a debate, never a question. Right? And the word Varnashram, it wasn't discussed because we're transcendental. We're Vaishnavas. So Varnashram is, it's not relevant. Mahaprabhu rejected it. Right? So Prabhupada's preaching always was, we need a class of brahmanas. We're actually transcendental, but we have to act as brahmanas teachers. That was, we're not trying to be Vedic, we're not trying to be Varnashram. And the whole of ISKCON was a brahminical community of people practicing brahminical principles. That's what it was for. That was Prabhupada's vision. It's a brahminical society. So you come to ISKCON, and what do you learn? 16 rounds, 4 regular principles. That's brahminical life, right? Okay. Now, any of you who have been in ISKCON a while know that although it might seem easy to chant 16 rounds a day and follow 4 regular principles, It's not as easy as it seems, and not everybody is so good at doing it. Even the people that were supposed to be good at doing it sometimes didn't do it so well. So, around 1975, Prabhupada said, not everyone is a Brahmin. Not everyone is a Vaishnava. And that was something he never said before. Because before, he said, we're training everyone to be Brahmins. Save the world, we need Brahmins. And now he's saying, not everyone's a Brahmin. Why did Prabhupada say that? Experience. Then Prabhupada started talking about Varnashram. And he said something which appears contradictory, because he said, who's Varnashram for? He said, it's not for us, it's for them. For everybody. And he said, why, Prabhupada? We have the chanting of Hare Krishna. And he said, no, but they don't chant Hare Krishna. Everybody's not going to chant, so we have to have Varnashram. They don't have to be Brahmins. Let them be Vaishyas, Sudras, whatever. And gradually, they'll be elevated. That's Varnashram, the slow train, not the fast train, not the express train. But then he said something, seemed to be contradictory. He said, Varnashram is also for us. Why, Prabhupada? He said, because some of you are falling down. You can't follow these principles. You're not Brahmins. Have you noticed that? We're trying to turn everyone into Brahmins, and some people are hard to turn into Brahmins. Have you noticed that? Yeah. It's like we have one Varna in ISKCON, and it's a problem because everybody's not in this Varna. It's like, welcome to Hare Krishna Temple. We're all Brahmins, and if you want to hang out with us, you have to become a Brahmin also. Here's the program. 16 rounds, 4 regs. Of course, you could start with one round, but the goal, you know, it's like if you've been around for 3 years and you're not chanting 16 rounds and you're not thinking about initiated, everybody looks at you like, oh my God, what's wrong with you? Isn't it? When are you getting initiated? Who's your guru? You know, so Prabhupada, observing that not everybody could do this, said, okay, Varnashram, but also for us, because let people come. They're not Brahmins. You don't have to train them as Brahmins. Of course, now, after this class, everyone's going to leave the temple and say, I realized after today's class I'm not a Brahmin. And then Shruti Dharma is going to, like, you know, excommunicate me from ISKCON. Hopefully that won't happen. But Prabhupada did say, the idea is that wherever you start, eventually you come to the mode of goodness through the purification process. So if you're not ready to be a Brahmin right away, you do what you do according to your ashram. You may not follow all the principles, chant Hare Krishna at all, or maybe a little bit, and then gradually you come. But as you know, in our temple, we're cultivating, for most of us, we're cultivating this Brahminical idea. Now, I think a very important point, we always say Brahmin is one who has knowledge. And at least we should understand for ourselves that that is true. A Brahmin must be knowledgeable. A guru must be knowledgeable. We must enlighten people. But we are taught we have to act what we teach, because the acting teaches louder than the teaching, isn't it? And I don't know if I talked about this last time, but one interesting phenomenon, and I think many of you who are teachers have observed this. You can teach something, but if the culture of the organization or the temple doesn't reflect what you teach, nobody will get that teaching, because you learn what's going on. You learn through the lives of others. You learn through the cultural values of what you learn. Just like if I say you should all be humble, and if I say the higher you rise in the organization, the more humble you should be, that won't make sense to you unless you see that. So if you see that the leaders of your community, they're the most humble, they serve the most, then what I say, it'll make sense and you'll be able to do it. But if the leaders, if as our leaders go up, as it happened in the early days, the higher the rank, the more control and power and obnoxious you became, basically. Often, not always, but arrogant, sometimes obnoxious, yes. That was a paradigm of 20. I mean, I was president when I was 19. So you 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, when they get power, what do? They become a little obnoxious. Prabhu, I don't feel good. I don't know if I can do that. Who cares how you feel? I told you to do it. I'm the president. Just do it. So if that's the example you see, and someone gives a class saying, leader means servant, humble, it's not going to register, is it? What registers is the example. And this is an amazing paradox you see as a teacher. When you're teaching, you realize if what I'm teaching doesn't coincide with the culture of the organization or the particular temple, it's not going to register. Does that make sense? So that means the example is more powerful than the teaching. Another thing that we also realize, that many of you realize, is that if you teach something and people don't see the example, then they don't understand how to apply it. Or they think it must not be applicable because nobody's applying it. It must just be in a book, and it must be these ancient sages of another age. They could do it, but I don't see anybody here doing it, so it's like what we call cognitive dissonance. It's like I don't see it happening, and so does it mean we're not supposed to do it? And this happened in Christianity. Because what do the Christians say? You're not perfect, you're forgiven, right? So what has happened in Christianity? If you, at least, this is my analysis. I'm not a theologian, but from at least from a certain perspective. Jesus was perfect. We can't be perfect. Which means you can't actually follow everything he taught. If you study the Bible, Jesus was very strict, right? You look at a woman, that's adultery. That's heavy. And he saw you as an adulterer if you looked at a woman with lust. Somebody slaps you in the face, give him the other cheek. That's heavy, isn't it? Who can do that? If somebody insults us, we have to insult them back. They didn't even slap us, isn't it? Have you ever fired back when someone fired at you? Yeah, and he's saying, he's not even talking about words, he's talking they slap you in the face. Okay, this other cheek is free now. If you need it, you can do it. Now that's very, very elevated, right? So they're looking at the teachings of Jesus, they're looking at themselves, and they're saying, there's a duality here. We can't live this way. Sermon on the Mount, amazing teachings, forgiveness, dedication, love thy neighbor as thyself. That means you give more to others than yourself. Live a simple life, all these. Jesus couldn't really have meant for us to live like that. You know, Jesus said it's better not to marry. Have you ever heard a Christian preacher preach that? Anybody? Raise your hand if you've heard it. He said it's better not to marry. Yeah, that's the... You give a Grihastha seminar, that's your instruction. This instruction will solve all future marital problems. It's better not to marry. You don't have any problems. So he actually said that. The ladies wouldn't be happy to hear that. Of course, we're just joking. But he said heavy things. Some of you are thinking, that's true. You know, I've been married for 40 years, and that's good advice. I would have solved a lot of problems if I didn't get married. So, we're just joking. Marriage is wonderful, right? It's an ashram, and it's necessary. So, but he gave very heavy instructions, and the people are looking at it, and they're looking around and saying, can you follow this one, slap in the cheek? Can you follow this one, you know, don't get married? Can you follow this one, forgive your enemies? And everybody's like, not really. Well, why did he teach it? Oh, it was just, that's what he does. It's just an example. That's what he does. We can't do that. So it keeps evolving. Well, if we can't do that, then what does it mean? That means we're falling short of what he taught. No, that's not It means that we're too fallen to do it. And because we're too fallen to do it, and he's merciful, he forgives us for not following the things he told us to do. Hello, I don't understand this. If we can't do it, why did he tell us to do it? No, he said the flesh is weak and we're sinful by nature and et cetera, right? Isn't it? So now it evolves down to a religion of not practice, but if you have faith, whatever that means, well, if I have faith, wouldn't I have faith in what he said? Wouldn't I try to follow? No, it's not about what he following him. It's about believing that he will save you from not following him. Something like that, right? And your head's twisting around. You're like, huh? But as it comes down over thousands of years, it all starts to seemingly make sense, although it actually makes no sense. Like, it doesn't make sense to us, does it? But it makes sense to these wild men on the street screaming at everybody that they're going to hell. What makes sense to them is, if God is merciful and he loves you, he'll save you just by believing in him, right? Because that's what mercy means, right? Of course, our philosophy is mercy means you follow the instruction and that's how you get the mercy. No, the mercy is not the instruction. The mercy is he just loves you. So, you know, you're imperfect and you're going to fall short. No matter how much you try, you're still going to be imperfect and fall short. So, you know, do your best and Jesus will do the rest, right? Those are the Brahmins in Kali Yuga. That's what they're preaching. You think that's going to help society? I just heard this amazing story I want to share with you. This will make your hair stand on end. Maybe you'll fall over on the floor and we'll have to end class with this ecstatic story. So, as you know, Prabhupada was working on Bhagavatam, and by 1970, he was actually working on the third canto. Did you know that? 1970, he was working on the third canto. And Krishna revealed something to Prabhupada in some kind of ecstasy. And Krishna revealed to Prabhupada that no one in the world knows who God is. They have no idea. It was just like, it was kind of like Krishna was telling Prabhupada, you have to translate the 10th canto. So that became the Krishna book, because nobody knows who God is. No one in the world knows who God is. And so Prabhupada stopped everything and he translated the Krishna book. He said, this will revolutionize the world, that we're the only ones who know who God is. And we'll revolutionize the world. We'll teach who God is and we'll remove the ignorance of the world. And we're the only ones who can do it. And I will stop translating everything and translate Krishna book. I heard that story the night before last. And what's so amazing about that story is when I read the Krishna book, I wrote a letter to Prabhupada and I said, Prabhupada, nobody knows who God is. And by distributing this book, they will know. I had the same realization. And now I heard this story 2 nights ago. I go, oh my God. That was the impetus for Prabhupada to write the book. So, you know, look at our position as Brahmins. We have so much to give. We have so much knowledge. But more important than what we're giving, more importantly, is we have to live it, because that's where the power is. Do you know that when Prabhupada came to America, do you know what convinced everybody more than what he was saying? Who knows? Who knows what convinced those first 5-10 people more than what he was saying? What? Example? Yeah, and there's something else in specifically part of that example. Well, I think it's in Lilamrita. Devotees in those days, everybody was trying to get high through use of psychedelic drugs. That was like the focal point, or one of the main focal points of the hippie generation, was to get high, to get the best LSD, the best mescaline, peyote, marijuana, hashish. That was just like, that was the focus. Just get high, get really high, and then what do? Just like whatever you do, it's so much better when you're high. So that was the mood, right? And here comes the Swami from India right into the hotbed of the hippie movement, and he's telling them, you don't need drugs. You can get high without drugs. How did he convince them? Well, you would say it was his preaching, it was his prasadam, it was the kirtan. But they said the thing that really convinced him was that he was higher than we were and we could see it. And he wasn't taking drugs. And that just was like, that was enough. Right? I have another story. There is a lady, she's from England, and she was part of Dr. Mishra's ashram. I think it's called Ananda Ashram. It's in upstate New York. That's where Prabhupada went when he was first coming, first maybe 65, 66. There was this Indian man who had a yoga ashram. And upstate New York means, well, maybe a couple hours from New York City where Prabhupada was in the country. They had an ashram. And we had done a japa workshop, a japa retreat near there, and they had invited us to come and do kirtan. So myself, Badahari, and Yadubar went there. And they were doing some satsang or something before the kirtan, and we were talking to one lady, a very nice lady. And she was a kirtanier also, and she liked devotees. Actually, I just saw her in Poland, and she said the reason she became a devotee was that Badahari, myself, and Yadubar came there and did kirtan, and after that she became a devotee. She was already becoming, but she told me, she's you know the group Premahara, Kamaniya, and you know that group? They come here? Premahara? No? Anyway, there's a group called Premahara. You can look them up. And they do kirtan everywhere. So she told me that Satchinanda Swami had come to the ashram and done a kirtan. And she's a very good kirtanier. And she said, when he did kirtan, I'd never seen anybody do kirtan with that level of bhakti, and I couldn't chant because I was embarrassed to sing because in comparison to him, I felt like a fake. Isn't that amazing? Just from the purity of his kirtan, you might say, wait a minute, Prabhu, he's supposed to get people to chant, and she's not chanting. No, but we understand that she was humbled by the purity of his chanting. Now there's another story. This is such a funny story, but it's so profound. One of our godbrothers, Rupanuga Prabhu, went to hear Srila Prabhupada in Buffalo, New York. Prabhupada came in 1968. And I was just hearing Lakshmi Moni, and she said she was there. And she said, I couldn't understand much. Both because of the philosophy, but the accent. And Prabhupada's accent was a little stronger. And we as Americans, maybe you as Britishers, could understand it better than we could. But it was difficult for us. So Rupanuga Prabhu, before he was Rupanuga, he was a student, or he was something in Buffalo. He heard the Swami speaking, and he went to hear him. And I heard him give a talk, and he said, when I heard the Swami speak, I didn't understand the accent. He said, and I couldn't understand one word he said. And this point, this next sentence is so powerful. This would be a great line for a song. He said, I couldn't understand one word he said, but I knew every word was true. Achara. Achara is how you act. Isn't that amazing? That Prabhupada's presence communicated so much bhakti that even you don't understand what he's saying, you know it's true. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Prabhupada says, sometimes a guru can make followers by his smile. And we might think, wait a minute, Didn't Prabhupada put down this guru by shock business? You know, you touch your disciple's head, disciple by shock, and then you transmit your shakti, and, you know, he's just smiling, and everybody's smiling. And, oh, Gurudev is so blissful. Did you see that smile? He was smiling at me, and my heart melted. And then we think, oh, that's all a bunch of gobbledygook sentiment, you know? But Prabhupada himself, of course, we know Prabhupada said guru is heavy in knowledge, but in one purport he said, sometimes the guru can make disciples by his smile, because that smile is infused with so much Krishna bhakti. And we have this shloka, Lava Matra. Sadhu Sangha, Sarva Siddhi Hoy, Lava Matra. You can get all perfection from 1/12 of a second. What can a guru say in 1/12 of a second? Right? You know, you see somebody, right? Now, if this happens today, you know, somebody comes to the temple. He walks by you. You walk out. You've never seen him before, and you walk outside. And the light strikes, and you realize, that's my guru. And you go to your temple authorities, and you tell them, I met my guru. What were they going to say? Going to say, I think you should think about it, because you actually only saw him for a Lava Matra, 1/12 of a second, and how could you make a decision? But Shastra, I'm not saying you should make a decision in 1/12 of a second, but Shastra is saying if you meet a sadhu for 1/12 of a second, that could change your life. Obviously, you didn't hear anything. And what did you get in 1/12 of a second? You got a lot by the presence of a sadhu. Now, what we experienced in Prabhupada's presence was something almost like Prabhupada's Krishna consciousness was so powerful, he could like alter everyone in the whole movement. Or to be in his presence was like, it was just his consciousness was just affecting all of us. And his desire to spread Krishna consciousness was bringing us. So it was a combination, our desire, his desire. And so the more you desire to make people Krishna conscious, the more it helps them. Did you know that? Prabhupada said, I'm always praying for you. If you want, maybe Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur, he said, the mercy, when someone gets the mercy, how do they get it? He said, because the devotee wants to give mercy, and then Krishna follows that direction. The devotee says, oh, I'd like to help this person. And Krishna says, okay, I'll give mercy. So you're kind of like Krishna. This one right here. Samsara Dava Nadali Loka, the mercy is coming from the ocean, and then the cloud, the guru is like the cloud. You know. So it's not his mercy, it's Krishna's mercy. So Krishna, can you be merciful? You have that relation with Krishna that you could ask him and he could do that. So the well wishes of a devotee are very powerful, isn't it? So if you become pure, Krishna fulfills your desire. He helps you affect other people. And if you become pure, sometimes you don't have to say much, but people see you and they think, this is amazing. And sometimes they think, Krishna consciousness is amazing because look at you. You are amazing. I've never met anybody like you. And sometimes I joke with devotees, sometimes it's the opposite. You go in the temple and everybody's, and they think, how are you going to make anybody other than a depressed person, you know? The depressed person will go, I feel at home here. But Prabhupada always used to say, you know, the happy faces of the Vaishnavas. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. And there's so much we can say, but time is limited. So, just an introduction to what it means to be a Brahmin. Thank you very much.